The Night Hops podcast is intended for you, but not your children. Listener discretion is advised.
I never even wanted to be in society. I just wanted to be a fucking Ninja Turtle when I grew up, you know?
And much like the turtles coming out of their shells, I am rocking and rolling.
Do they see you rolling, Trevor? Are they hating?
They're going to catch me riding dirty.
They're going to catch you riding dirty, saying the whole word like this. Oh, I believe that was that's a Riley Freeman bit, isn't it? That show was brilliant, and I hope Aaron McGruder got enough money to go live on a fucking private island in Panama.
This may be very echoey where I'm doing this. I'm hoping my setup compensates. We will see. All of my audio engineering knowledge is self-taught, and most of it's just chutzpah.
I have imposter syndrome, Trevor. You have it so bad that you question the validity of your imposter syndrome.
Am I good enough to have imposter syndrome? So, Matt, I think it's time. This has long been a creature of myth, of Nighthawk's legend. Did we do it? Didn't we do it? The evidence just simply isn't there for either argument.
We did it. I know it in my heart. And I've had it with your mandala effect gaslighting.
Oh, you know what we should do before we get too carried away is do a slate.
Slate.
3, 2, 1.
So no, like I checked the receipts. I went through the chat log. I showed you my findings. I think we planned on a poltergeist episode. We may have planned on one twice. And I think we even got as far as watching the movie and pre-gaming. But I do not think we ever set voice to tape.
We recorded it in person on analog tape in a streetcar.
Named Desire.
No, named Desiree. That's the twist.
Oh. Bella! Bella!
Stella Dora Breakfast Treats.
I was thinking Bella Lugosi since it's Halloween. It's Monstoberfest.
Oh, I was thinking of the Patton Oswalt Stella Dora Breakfast Treats bit.
Well, see, that's you're a stand-up comedian, so you think of things in stand-up comedian, and I think of things.
No, I'm a person with one Patton Oswalt CD stuck in his CD player for the last 36 months.
Well, folks, we're here. We're going to do it. It's going to happen. Maybe we talked about it. Maybe we did it before, but we're definitely doing it now.
The house looks just like the one next to it. And the one next to that. And the one next to that. A young couple live in it.
Give Ken a kiss.
You are so obnoxious.
With their three children. And something more.
Last night, do you remember when you woke up and you
yes.
said you were here?
Uh-huh.
Well, who did you meet? Who's here?
TV
people.
Something's funny going on here next door. Something,
We were wondering if maybe you had experienced any disturbances lately.
What kind of disturbances?
I don't know what hovers over this house.
Spielberg crosses a frightening new threshold into a world within our own. Its form is revealed.
What is it?
Its focus is clear. And the games are over. Poltergeist, It knows what scares you.
And we are going to be talking about Poltergeist for this month's Toberfest episode of the Nighthawks podcast. Sitting in your conceptual Nighthawks diner, I am Trevor T. Trujillo, one of your co-hosts. And I'm a film critic. I'm an operations administrator for a museum where I am recording tonight. Thank you to the Science Zone for the use of the Artemis recording facilities. And with me, as always, stand-up comedian Mr. Matt Foster. How are you?
I'm all right, and I'm currently a sit-down with Kitty comedian.
And actually, you've been doing way more film criticism than I have lately. I've been really tied up with family stuff lately, so we're happy to be able to bring you this episode, and this episode of the Nighthawks podcast brought to you by our wonderful patrons at our coffee page. Stop by, swing by, and you can make this podcast happen all the easier, all the more efficiently, which means more content for you. And so we will have that link available in our show notes. But yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to talk about the classic 1982 film directed by Tobe Hooper. I was going to say Joe Dante, and that's not right. It was one of the other masters of horror. It was Tobe Hooper who brought us such classics as The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And if you want to dig into the Monstoberfest archives, Tobe Hooper was also the director on Life Force, the naked vampire movie. And so you can check out the Nighthawks special episode on Life Force. But tonight we're talking about Tobe Hooper's Steven Spielberg-produced Poltergeist, starring Coach.
Starring hyper-relevant, current-time reference Coach.
But yeah, be sure to find the Nighthawks podcast on Facebook at Nighthawks Pod on X, and we're working on getting Blue Sky and Threads going. We're lazy. We're working on this episode instead of working on social media. So find us there. You can also find us at the podcaster of your choice, like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podomatic, Amazon, Audible, Player FM, iHeartRadio, Deezer, just wherever good podcasts are caught, find us there. And if you have the ability to rate and review our podcast, please do so. So, Matt, are you ready to embark into the haunted house?
I think there's one explanation that we haven't considered, and maybe it's that spiritual forces deleted the recording.
Oh, magic more than science. I like it.
Someone called Zach Bagans. Our hair isn't spiky enough to explore this phenomenon.
All right, folks. Well, in our discussion tonight of the Poltergeist film from 1982, we will not be deploying our typical spoiler curtain. This movie is darn near 40 years old, a little older than that. So, folks, if you haven't seen it yet, it's a good watch. This is a PG-rated, PG-13 in spirit horror film that's probably appropriate for younger, but maybe not necessarily the little kids in the family. But this would be a good kind of adolescent family watch for the Halloween season. And it's a really just good spooky ghost story. There weren't a lot of these when I was growing up. This was kind of the penultimate. You didn't get much better than this one.
This is the literal archetypical PG-13 movie, is it not? This is the one that they could not decide if it should be PG or R.
This is one of the golden way. It was like this, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Temple of Doom. And finally, they decided to instate the PG-13 rating, and our first PG-13 movie was Red Dawn.
Well, Red Dawn should be G-rated, because children need to know how to be patriots.
Well, in our movie tonight, we are following the Freeling family. They are, in a way, the perfect family. Mom, dad, son, teenage daughter, and a young, precocious Carol Ann. Dad, who, for reasons we will call Coach, works for a real estate developer and got in on the ground floor of a brand new development where he now lives a seemingly bucolic life of kids, TV football games, neighbors, pets, Unfortunately, it turns out that somehow, eyebrows, the brand new house is incredibly haunted, and the spirits in the home have kidnapped young Carol Ann into the ghostly ether. With nowhere else to turn, the Freelings are beset with the wild machinations of the ghosts, while a team of ghost hunters realize they're in over their heads. So now we must resort to the powers of a powerful but shortened stature human medium to get Carol Ann away from the ghosts and to get the ghosts out of the house. What's your history with this? Were you well acquainted with Poltergeist? I know we've watched it at least once before, so.
Did we? Did we do that, or were we possessed? I think dark forces are conspiring against our previous Poltergeist episode. I think that's what happened. I watched all of the Poltergeist movies fairly young. For whatever reason, they were deemed not quite salacious enough for like a full ban. And I even had Poltergeist, I want to say 2 and 3 recorded on VHS. You know, recorded off air, and I had to mess with the tracking. They call it tracking, but what were you tracking?
The scan lines on the... Never mind.
If I adjusted the tracking enough, was I going to find a bear?
Poltergeist, as a franchise, is one that tends to get misremembered, where we associate parts of 3 with part 2, and we associate parts of part 2 with part 1. And so it's always interesting to me how much of the Poltergeist lore that's kind of entered the zeitgeist is actually from the sequels, and how tightly contained and self-contained this first movie is.
Poltergeist definitely has the problem of it is a bit memed at this point. Like, it's been sort of like openly parodied on The Simpsons, and it's one of those ones that kind of defined the culture of other horror movies. If you've never seen it before and you watched it today, I think it would be diminished in pure scariness because of that. But as far as its effectiveness and its interestingness as a movie, I think it actually holds up pretty good. You know, there's dust on a few practical effects here. There's some in-camera ghosts and stuff that are a little odd by today's standards. There's work in this that reminds me a lot of Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
But all that said and done, this is a pretty cool movie. Predates the evolution of the paranormal activity / supernatural ghost rules that pervade all paranormal movie making and all paranormal reality show making now. I don't want to say it's one of the first ones, because there's a few, I think, where they tried some serious, like, you know, they were going to take a tape recorder out and record a possession or something like that in a few horror movies. But this is one of the first ones where you have the, like, investigatory team shows up at the house. I think what I constantly misremember about Poltergeist, there's some scenes in it that really, really got to me as a little kid. But then when I rewatch it now, what I forget is, like, how down to business it is.
Yeah, this is a really efficient script.
You know, it's a weird convention if you think about it, that for some reason, and the reason is because it's convenient for the level of tension in the movie, if it just escalates the way you'd like a movie plot to escalate. It's very odd that these powers and dominions that interfere from the other, like, I came all the way from the other side, and for like in 7 days I can kill you, but for now I'm just going to knock over this apple. See that? I knocked over an apple. That's like your warning. And then, like, tomorrow, I'm going to tell you to get out. And then Thursday, I'm going to, like, just touch the nape of your neck while you're in the shower. Which, by the way, as an invisible presence in your home, shower more, please. Poltergeist doesn't do that. And Poltergeist, man, this bitch is haunted, you know? Like, it's haunted. Like, it's straight up haunted.
Last night, when you said they're here...
Can I take my goldfish to school?
You know, maybe the fault line runs just directly under our house. Wouldn't that be a scream?
Someone got crumbs all over my bed.
Sweetie, remember last night? Do you remember when you woke up and you said they were here?
Uh-huh.
Well, who did you mean? Who's here?
The TV people. She's dumb.
Oh, yeah, what do you know about it?
More than you.
The parents are not... I like that they don't degenerate into the normal, like, there's a little bit of stress over it, but they don't have the, like, the typical alignment. The stern father is very scared. I don't have time for all this non-scientific rubbish. I don't want to let some lady from your yoga class burn her sage in our home, you know? And then the mom is just unheard and increasingly spiteful. And in this one, they're kind of like, yeah, that definitely should not be moving like that. That's pretty weird. The scene where the investigator is like, My last case, I got definitive proof. I charted a, a matchbox car. I charted a matchbox car moving a distance of 7 feet. It took me 17 hours of time-lapse photography to capture it all. And then Craig T. Nelson's like, oh, well, that's very interesting. And he opens this door where it's just like shit in the kids' bedrooms, just like flying around.
That is something I forget and never give this movie credit for, is how funny it can be. Because there is some almost straight-up slapstick in the beginning of this, as we're setting up the Freelings' idyllic lifestyle. And you've got, you know, the drunk guy on the beer run on his bicycle, and the kids are playing with their RC cars trying to knock him over, and they succeed. And then there's a little war of the remote controls between Coach and his next door neighbor. And it's all for a purpose. It sets up a scene, and Coach's antagonistic relationship with his neighbor actually plays into the movie later. But it is allowed to be goofy from time to time. And Craig T. Nelson is sometimes allowed to kind of mug and do what he's good at and be a comedian. That is something I've never really given this movie credit for that it does very well, is that comedy push-pull that Amblin would later become famous for, speaking of associations with Steven Spielberg. See also our episode on arachnophobia.
I can't believe they were called Amblin Entertainment. We're just ambling around making movies. You may have heard of us in our previous incarnation, Saunter Productions, a subsidiary of Stroll Corp.
What I do like about Poltergeist that I noted to talk about on this record is there's a lot of deft writing here. Like, the script is very lean. It's very well written. Things are set up and paid off very well. There's a ton of foreshadowing just in the beginning of this movie. There's a dead bird situation where the little girl's bird dies. Just as mom is about to throw it in the toilet, in walks the little girl. She sees that the bird is dead, and so now we have to throw this funeral. The dead bird portends the dead spirits, and Carol Ann is very sensitive to what this bird needs. Here's a piece of licorice if he gets hungry. Here's a blankie if he gets cold. Here's a picture of the family in case he gets lonely. And she's very sensitive to the needs of the dead. And they go out in the garden and bury the bird. Two scenes later, they are digging up the same garden. The cigar box that the bird is in is being kicked up so they can put in a pool. And that foreshadows the whole twist in this movie, the whole twist in the plot, which is that when this land developer came in and put in all of these estates, they were on top of a cemetery where they cut corners, move the headstones, and not the bodies underneath. Hence, we have literal dead bodies, literal skeletons floating around in their pool outside, a lot of angry spirits who have been disrupted. There's just a lot of that in this script that where we set up things and pay them off later. Another one is the boy Robbie is contending with trying to climb a tree, and it's kind of a gnarly looking tree that sits right outside his window. He's scared of it. He's trying to conquer it. And that is all visualized in the very beginning and the first few minutes with him attempting to climb the tree as just a boyhood activity.
Well, yeah, all that stuff is really deft. And then the other thing that I like about this movie is there is a solid explanation for why this house and these people specifically, which is that he works for the company and lives there. Right. Typically, you're wondering, like, well, if all of this is built on an Indian burial ground, which, for the record, it all is, people, all of it, East Coast to West Coast. But that's a plot hole, because, like, if it's really that many places where nobody died or nobody got murdered, so why are hauntings always so specific in these movies? Well, this is a punitive, plot-driven haunting with a backstory. He is responsible for the state of things, and so he is an avenue for divine retribution. I don't know, but there are some things I don't like in this. I didn't think the actor playing the son was like, super great. He was a little bit of a child actor. And I didn't like that when they gave their ages, the couple is like 32 and my wife's, or wasn't he 34 and his wife's 32? And like, did people just look older back then?
Apparently, you know? Some internet sleuths have kind of done the math on that. And it's implied that because of the age of the eldest teenage daughter, that mom was about 16 when mom and dad hooked up. It is explained, I guess, in the novelization, mom is actually a second marriage for Coach.
Was that written by Alan Dean Foster, no relation?
One can only hope.
My man was a major player in the novelization game.
Oh, dude, he did all the best Alien novelizations.
Yeah, I mean, he's no Dean Koontz, but he gets a few novels out a year.
Another thing I like about this, just from a storytelling perspective, is when we are introduced to the ghost hunters, number one, it's kind of an all walks of life calling, it appears. That they're all different ages, different racial backgrounds, like very different people, this little trio, that are just kind of unified by this mission that they believe in ghosts and they want to prove their existence.
One of them's a bit of Lothario, one of them's a collector of spores, molds, and funguses, and one of them is a future lunatic.
Strong Ghostbuster vibes throughout this whole movie. I couldn't believe it. But part of it is I like how the ghost hunters came in skeptical. They were ready to kind of accuse the Freelings of, you know, drumming up publicity and trying to get rich off of this or trying to get some attention or something. They really approach it from a, there may not be anything here. Of course, that is out the window immediately upon coming into the kids' room where shit's flying all over the room. And, you know, obviously something is going on.
Well, I always kind of liked how they work through the phenomenon kind of logically. Like, there's a portal in the kids' room, so let's see what we can do in terms of, like, finding out where it comes out and how far you travel through the portal. And they run a rope through it, which is kind of Rube Goldbergian, but very satisfying dramatically, you know, later. It's just kind of cool because they sort of just do what you do. Well, I don't know, throw something in there, you know?
Well, and, like,
write your name on a tennis ball and throw it in.
When shit gets a little too real, too, one of them bounces. He's like, no, this is too much for me. Like, I am not ready to handle the truth. It can stay out there.
Yeah, that is the meat guy, right?
Yeah, that's the guy who hallucinates pulling his own face off in this PG movie. In our probably one lone moment of gore in this whole movie.
Well, there's then there's that in the, you know, all the skeletons at the end.
That's true, which were allegedly all real skeletons that they had gotten kind of on a deep discount, much to the chagrin, after she was informed, after the scene was over, to our lead actress here.
Can you donate your body to special effects?
I don't see why you couldn't.
That wasn't like one of those things where, like, you think you're donating your body to science and they use it to test the new Alludium Pu-38 space modulator for the U.S. government or anything. Was it? Like, did the people know they were going to be in pictures?
I don't think so. It was a different time back then, Matt.
It would be really ironic if they were, like, just bodies that were in the process of being displaced from a burial ground and then they haunted the movie.
Well, that is one theory of something that may have happened off screen, but we'll talk about that later. What I want to talk about right now is that it's cool to me that the ghost hunters who are there to prove a phenomenon that is supernatural are the science arm of this movie. They represent hard science, evidence. They are science. And then we have our other player here, Tangina, who then represents faith and magic and supernatural and the mystical. And how in this situation that is very decidedly supernatural, there are still two approaches to it. There is the approach of faith in a medium and psychic powers. And then there is the, we measure this EMP, we measure this, the temperature in the room and the hygrotherm and all of these things. And so that was very interesting to me, especially now having this whole history in television of ghost hunters, ghost adventures. Ghost hunting has become kind of a cottage industry. This was the discussion back then of, you know, what is science versus faith? And we're still having to have that conversation now. It was kind of an interesting tidbit there. Well, and you even mentioned that is Tangina supposed to be a swipe at the female half of the Warren couple, Lorraine Warren?
Oh, you don't have to say her name.
Well, and that's why you asked me that, and I was a little reluctant to say that, because I like Tangina as a character. I think she's a neat presence in this movie, and when I saw this movie as a kid, which I also saw it very, very young, and have very early impressions of both the first and second movie. Tangina was kind of the needle drop in this movie that I was always waiting for as a kid. I was waiting for her to show up because this movie then really kicks into high gear with the spooky ghost stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of the moment when the movie says, it's on.
There is no death. It is only a transition to a different sphere of consciousness. Carol Ann is not like those she's with. She is a living presence in their spiritual earthbound plane. They're attracted to the one thing about her that's different from themselves. Her life force. It is very strong. It gives off its own illumination. It is a light that implies life and memory of love and home and earthly pleasures. Something they desperately desire, but can't have anymore. Right now, she's the closest thing to that. And that is a terrible distraction from the real light that has finally come for them. Do you understand me? These souls who, for whatever reason, are not at rest are also not aware that they have passed on. They're not part of consciousness as we know it. They linger in a perpetual dream state, a nightmare from which they cannot wake. Inside this spectral light is salvation. A window to the next plane. They must pass through this membrane where friends are waiting to guide them to new destinies. Carol Ann must help them cross over, and she will only hear her mother's voice. Now, hold on to yourselves. There's one more thing. A terrible presence is in there with her. So much rage, so much betrayal. I've never sensed anything like it. I don't know what hovers over this house, but it was strong enough to punch a hole into this world, take your daughter away from you. He keeps Carol Ann very close to it and away from the spectral light. It lies to her. It says things only a child can understand. It has been using her to restrain the others. To her, it simply is another child. To us, he is the beast.
She is very frustrating, though. And, like, psychic talent in movies always seems to be distributed to people that are inclined towards psychic talent, you know, that are appropriately eccentric. It's never right. Just like a guy, I'm Bill. Most days I plumb, some days I psychic.
So, as we mentioned, we have Craig T. Nelson in this movie. Something that I actually have misremembered from my childhood. I remembered Coach being kind of mean and being very stern and very strict, but that isn't actually present here. He's kind of surprisingly okay, and even though there is some grumbling, there is some complaining, it's not ever destructive, it's not abusive, it's just kind of, you know, a cranky dad. Now, when Tangina shows up, he is also annoyed with her. He kind of has a passive-aggressive way of making his skepticism known. Six-year-old me thought that was mean because he was being mean to the character that I liked. 42-year-old Trevor watching this movie now says, I would probably be doing the exact same thing.
Well, yeah, and I mean, she is cartoonish and, like, should kind of expect that.
Well, she takes it in stride, I mean.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's like, if she doesn't want to put people in a skeptical place, she doesn't have to deal in so much associated hokum. She's straight up telling people they need to be more spiritual. Well, no, because they don't need to be more spiritual, because if you actually have the ability to perceive this phenomenon, which are real, and they document them with cameras and instruments, then it is no longer faith-based. You just have a sense that people lack to detect a phenomenon that is real, so why is it magical? They don't, like, cast a spell to get the kid back. She goes in there, you know, dangling on a rope and gets her. So it's like, well, wait, what did she really do except point these things out, you know?
Well,
you know,
that's like, the other thing, Matt, is as much as the ghost hunters are science and as much as Tangina is faith, they both fail. Neither, like, they get Carol Ann back, But nobody gets the house clean. Tangina walks away dusting, you know, clapping the dust off of her hands and says, "This house is clean." And then the ghosts are back 45 minutes later. That is the other thing to contextualize here is, despite if you measure it with science or faith, this bad guy is bad enough that it transcends both, and both of those approaches fail. And that brings us to the crux of the other point, is that this is 100% Jo Beth Williams' movie. She plays Diane Freeling. In my mind, Coach was kind of the lead guy because he was the dad, and we live in a patriarchy, and I'm a male, and that's what I grew up with. But when you watch this, Coach is missing for some of it. He's at work. He's quitting work. He's hanging out and investigating and trying to figure out what's going on. All of the stuff in the house happens to Mom. And she's ultimately the one that gets Carol Ann out. And she's ultimately the one that kind of does battle at the climax when the ghosts come back for a vengeance.
It's always kind of interesting to me because, like, at a certain point, like, we decided the haunted house was a domestic phenomenon. It's a haunted house. Like I said, the common trope is that the woman that's there all day sees the thing happen. And then the man that's gone most of the day doesn't believe her. Right? We've seen that over and over again. You know, and it's almost subverted for cause in, like, the Paranormal Activity movies when it's always the boyfriend that sets up the recording equipment. You know, it's like, we're going to settle this. I'm gonna set up some game cameras and we're going to catch this thing. I always find that kind of intriguing, but it's also, like, very much playing into the idea that the men are down to earth and mean and grumpy and women are spiritual and deep, you know, by default. It's very strange because, like, even though the guy is usually kind of the heel, the trope itself still somehow manages to be, like, benevolently sexist, you know? We kind of, like, don't get as much of that here because he doesn't react like that. He's like, oh, yeah, that chair moved. We should call somebody, you know? Maybe he didn't think the somebody should have been Tangina, which I have been graciously not pronouncing Tangina at any point until now. But sometimes that low-hanging fruit is out there. Sometimes it's a tangerine. Sometimes it's a Tangina. So I don't know. I don't know how it, like, but the dynamic felt fresher here, and it felt like its beat sheet was newer, and the ruts were not as worn when this movie came out, and you can tell. I actually watched the first Amityville this week as well, and it was very interesting how much more plot-wise that felt like a modern horror movie, because it's just a very brooding father losing his mind, which, you know, to be fair to Amityville, it was also one of the early examples of that, but it felt like so much more like, oh, at some point, somebody decided that this was how these were going to be. And then they made like 31 movies about it because they're in the public domain. And some of them are real bad.
Friend of the podcast, Greg Orm, is kind of slowly working his way through any movie with Amityville in the title that he can get his hands on. And guys, there are some stinkers.
Yeah, he's had to, like, call people a couple times for, like, emergency liquor.
And I don't think he's even tipped into, like, the really bad stuff, like Amityville Toilet.
Yeah, he called me the other night. He's like, can you come duct tape my hand so I don't claw my own eyes out? You can. Leave. I'll pause it while you're here. There's also some weirdness around Poltergeist as a franchise because it was kind of a fraught set of productions. And I think it was the lack of a... Obviously, there were some tragic events that we should... I don't know how into that you want to get.
But we'll get there. We'll get
there.
There's also a
lack of a... There's no Chucky here. There's no Annabelle here. There's no Freddy here.
Right.
And they sort of tried to fix that in number two. The one that I always... That was always my big comment here is that this is much like Friday the 13th, this is a franchise where a lot of people's imagery associations with it are actually from the second movie, apart maybe from the pool of bodies.
Well, and really, because there was no face to this menace, the franchise was really built around Carol Ann, who is the little girl in this story and is basically a Precious Moments figure animated and brought to life. Like just this angelic blonde hair, blue eyed little apple cheeked angel. They built the franchise around her. She is unfortunately one of the victims of the tragic history of this franchise. One of the other people associated with this production who was associated with that is Dominique Dunn, the daughter of Dominic Dunn, the famous journalist. My question for you, though, Dominique Dunn plays the Freelings' teenage daughter. Why is she in this movie? And she's barely in it. She's really never menaced by the ghosts. She's not part of the solution. She's not there for the resolution. She's absent for a lot of this. I do not know why this character is here.
So that she could be more important in Poltergeist 3?
Maybe, but unfortunately the actress died before this movie came out. So trying to build a franchise on her didn't work either. Just sitting down and analyzing this, Dominique Dunn represents some of the only, even though she's only 16, represents some of the only overt sexuality in the movie. And that's that she's catcalled by the people digging the pool when she's on her way to school and gives them a hilarious up yours. I hate to reduce it to that, but that's really what it feels like, is like this was their chance to get just a little bit of sex in there. And we utilized this 16-year-old actress in her one and only film credit to do that.
I think the teenage daughter is useful as a third voice when the kids are being awkward and as a third person that can do adult things like go to the store, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I can sort of see why you want to balance out the family a little bit, but it was like...
She didn't serve any of those functions, like...
There definitely was not enough for her to do, you know? I don't know what she... The only thing I can think of is she does make some of that dialogue with the kids a little more bearable. There's a few scenes that are just from a different movie here when they're like eating breakfast cereal and throwing at each other and stuff. But yeah, she's definitely a bit disposable here, plot-wise. Like, what are we to think? She doesn't have a strong voice insofar as the haunting is concerned, like the how they should handle it. She's not really old enough to have any chemistry with, like, the younger paranormal investigators, which is something I was afraid they were setting up. You know, some of these 80s movies, they listen to a few, like, You're 16, You're Beautiful, and You're Mine.
Yeah.
This is a different time back then. People got age inappropriate, especially movies with the words sleepaway and camp in the title.
Or the whole scandalous history of Indiana Jones and Marion Ravenwood, as discussed on our Raiders of the Lost Ark episode. Like, there was some sketchy shit going on in those writers' rooms back in the day.
Well, you know, it was 1980, 80, 85. People, 82. People only lived to be about 40-ish. Life expectancy back then, that was, you know, pre-Giuliani. Shit was pretty raw out.
It is amazing, though, for as middle-aged as Coach and his wife look. They also, knowing what Coach looks like now, he's a baby in this.
For the younger audience, there was a time when people liked Rudy Giuliani because he lowered the crime in New York and cleaned up Times Square. That was before his public and literal meltdown recently.
I'm going to get this on tape. You've heard me say this, Matt, 1,000 times. I'm going to say it one more time just so it's on Memorex. All that motherfucker had to do after 9/11 was sit down, shut up, keep his head low, stay out of the public eye, and he would have gone down in history as America's mayor.
Just shut the fuck up and go to Peter Lucas twice a week until you die.
But no. The allure of the spotlight was just too much, and now you're the ass end of a Borat movie. Way to go, Giuliani.
Literally, melt in public?
How's that spot for a bay window, huh?
Yeah, well, it's pretty nice if you're living up here, but not so great down there in the valley, having to look at a bunch of homes cutting into the hillside.
Well, you don't have to live in the valley anymore.
What are you saying?
We're starting phase 5 right here where we're standing. All of this can be your master bedroom suite. That can be your view. Interesting.
Well, Mr. Teague, you know, that's a generous offer. I'm just
You're
not a developer.
You're responsible for 42% of sales. That's almost half of everything down there. Almost $70 million worth of dwelling and properties. Now, that's a whole generation of security that nobody can put a price tag on. Now, look, I know we should have made you a full partner 3 years ago. Well, I don't want to lose you now.
How much room for a pool is there?
We own all the land. We've already made arrangements for relocating the cemetery.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh, come on. I mean, that's sacrilegious, isn't it?
Oh, don't worry about it. After all, it's not ancient tribal burial ground. It's just people. Besides, we've done it before.
When?
In 76. Right down there.
quest of Verdi?
All 300 acres, and let me tell you, it was quite a deal.
No, but I never heard anything about it, though.
Well, it's not the sort of thing one goes around advertising on a billboard or on the side of a bus. What are you worried about? Friends and relatives can visit their loved ones in Broxton Memorial Park. It's only 5 minutes further, for Christ's sake.
Oh, yeah, well, 5 minutes, you know, that's no great hardship. Yeah, I suppose that'd be okay.
Okay with who?
Whomever might complain.
Nobody's complained until now.
Did this scare you when you were a kid?
Not really. Like, the clown part's pretty creepy.
I think this was the origin of a lot of modern clown fear. This was the wellspring. It was this and it.
But I've always been pretty solidly in the, like, two-dimensional things don't bother me that much. There's some weird exceptions. Like, there's a couple of specific flavors of gore that I don't really like. I don't like things that kind of really look like an image I can smell. Like some of those old giallo zombie movies where the things look really old and squishy. I don't necessarily love that, but it doesn't... Almost nothing in a horror movie makes me like scared it's going to happen the next time I go out the door. But I found these very affecting. They did lead me down that thought process of, wait, like people have lived in these houses before? Mommy, are we the first? Was this house new? This is a new house. I mean, that's no guarantee, but tell me it was, you know? And that's the psychological impact that this had on me, is just the crushing revelation that, like, we live out in the country. Like, I bet they didn't even go to the hospital when Grandpa started to falter. They probably died right there in Mom and Dad's bedroom. Wonder if he stands there every night and watches them do whatever parents do. Pray for the stork to come.
If this movie is to be believed, what the parents do in that bedroom is Coach can't roll a doobie, but they smoke some weed.
You ever fight a poltergeist for the safety and life of your adorable little daughter on weed? Yeah, see, then there was the type of smoker where you'd go to their house to sell it, and they were like needing the weed to cope with a paranormal phenomenon inhabiting their house because of displaced bodies. Yeah, those were some of our best customers. At Mr. Smiley Face. Sorry, that let some air out of the room. That reference was half-baked.
It's not the air let out of the room, it's the weed that's let in.
Maybe you should smoke that reference in editing.
Well, Matt, there is one controversy about who really directed this movie. Now, we said at the top of the show, it says in the credits, it says on all the promotional material, that this movie is directed by Tobe Hooper, the creator of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Now, there is legend, apocryphal tale, some accusations that maybe Spielberg directed most of this movie. That he, being an alpha kind of aggressive type, was a little pushy on set, got his way, did a lot of the grunt work and the sweat work that goes into directing. And Tobe Hooper, who is a little more passive and not as aggressive, just kind of let himself get steamrolled. Do you have any takes here?
Somehow there ended up being like a formal, like someone with the Writers Guild or Directors Guild checked, right?
Yes. So at one point, and this is the reason I think people seize on this so much, at one point Spielberg said that he had directed the movie pretty much and had since walked that back. Because apparently it was said in a moment of consternation with Tobe Hooper. But enough was said about it that the DGA opened an investigation into the issue, and they didn't find anything. They kept the credits the way they were. And so that's one in the notch for Tobe Hooper. A lot of people on set have said that Tobe Hooper did most of the directing. Some people on set said that Spielberg was actually more of the guy. And it seems to me that it kind of depends on who you're talking to, how often they were on set, and for what parts. I think Spielberg was probably absolutely there any time that there was a special effect involved. And that's just the kind of guy he is anyway. He's there for the fun stuff. The apocryphal tale further goes that he was kind of champing at the bit because he was supposed to be directing E.T., but that production was delayed. He was contractually obligated to not work on anything else, So he just spent a lot of time on set as a, quote, producer. And then the tale goes that he was assertive and aggressive and ended up directing from his producer chair. And Tobe Hooper kind of led him.
I think the other big thought process there is how little this movie certainly looks more like a Spielberg movie than the Texas Chainsaw Massacre does. You know,
that's true.
And so if that's the one Tobe Hooper movie you've watched, you're like, this isn't the same guy.
But,
you know,
and see, and Matt, I'm with you because in my adult life, I've seen a lot more Tobe Hooper movies. And I actually, as an adult watching Poltergeist, I see a lot of Tobe Hooper in here, especially Texas Chainsaw 2, Life Force, and Invaders from Mars. There's a lot of similar lighting schemes and the way the kind of camera moves and the way things are lit and the way they're presented. So I tasted a lot of Tobe Hooper on this watch through. When I might have been kind of a controversial guy just for the sake of being controversial and saying, it was really directed by Spielberg. I don't know, man. I saw a lot of Hooper in it this time.
So we're doing phrasing again?
And also, why would you hide it? Hollywood is not afraid of taking a director off a movie and putting another one on. Like, here we are 41 years later. Like, somebody would have eventually said something, especially now that Hooper's dead.
You can credit two people on something, and, like, I know that you want to sign your work, but Jesus, if Steven Spielberg wanted to co-direct my movie in public, and I got points on the movie, I would be like, yeah, you can put Spielberg on there if he's willing to be on there. Like, yeah, play, yeah. I dare say that Steven Spielberg is the polar opposite of Alan Smithy.
Well, it is worth mentioning. We like to talk about some Oscars on the show every now and then. The Oscar, this was nominated for two of them. Yeah, Poltergeist Special Effects and the score by Jerry Goldsmith. Excellent score by Jerry Goldsmith. Were both nominated for Oscars. Both of those Oscars lost to E.T. And so I think there might have been a thing where, like, Spielberg had two movies out, and E.T. obviously eclipsed Poltergeist in many, many regards. And so I think there was this kind of, well, Spielberg's the wunderkind. He's had this series of hits. And he even directed Poltergeist, even though you heard the other guy did it. I think Spielberg was just very hot back then. A lot of people wanted to give him a lot of credit. And I think that's where this comes from. Do I think he was on set? Do I think he did some directing? Absolutely. I think he did it on Arachnophobia as well. We heard stories about him hanging out in the truck with Jeff Daniels and having these conversations with, he's a very hands-on producer. Sometimes I bet that translates to the fact that he directs a scene or two or three or the majority of it. But I don't know that he had the vision. I think that he had the mechanics. I think that he got stuff done. But I really think this looks like something Hooper would put together, and I think this is Hooper's movie. That's my take as a 42-year-old movie fan right now.
That's what the experts decided too, right?
Yeah, DGA said there was no reason to change the credits.
I have to say, if the DGA had a bias, it would probably be toward not displeasing Spielberg. Although I guess he wasn't quite as Spielberg as he is now.
So Matt, the other controversy we kind of have to wade into, that was the science. This is the mysticism. The Poltergeist series is notorious in urban legend circles and mysticism circles as being a cursed film. And Matt, as you had joked earlier, part of the theory is that because they desecrated actual bodies and used actual skeletons in the production, that this whole thing was haunted and cursed to begin with, and was thus beset with much tragedy. I'm not inclined to believe that, but it is a franchise that has a lot of tragedy associated with, and I think that's just a sad accident. I'm not much of one for curses, but this is kind of famous for it. Just to run down the list, we mentioned actress Dominique Dunn died after her boyfriend assaulted her and put her into a coma, and that was just before the 1982 release of Poltergeist. After production, but before the release. And then moving on to Poltergeist 2, the Kane figure, you could tell they were really wanting this guy to be the face of what Poltergeist would be moving forward. He died of diagnosed stomach cancer after production on Poltergeist 2, but before Poltergeist 2 was released. One of the other good guys in Poltergeist 2 was Will Sampson from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Outlaw Josie Wales. He died after Poltergeist 2 was released from complications arising after a series of known health issues. The thing of it is Julian Beck and Will Sampson were both diagnosed with these conditions long before they even signed on for the movie. So their death being the result of a curse is unlikely. Heather O'Rourke, the little girl who plays Carol Ann tragically, unexpectedly died several years after production of Poltergeist 1 and during production of Poltergeist 3, but before the release of Poltergeist 3, she had unexpected complications following several diagnoses and treatments for various health concerns. Just a really tragic death all around. And then some people will also lump in the death of Zelda Rubinstein in 2010 following a heart attack at age 76. But at that point, I think you're really reaching. Like, eventually, all of the people associated with Poltergeist are going to die. And that's not a curse, that's time. Just like all of the people associated with the production of Casablanca are dead. That's not a curse, that's just because Casablanca is an 80-year-old movie.
Well, no disrespect to Julian Beck, but I don't think they cast him because of his aura of vigor.
Health. Yeah. You know?
like, look at that guy. He looks just like a zombie preacher.
So, yeah, Matt, we finally did it. We finally talked about Poltergeist. Do you have anything else you wanted to add?
I like this movie because it passes my mythology test, which is there's sort of a moral test in it and a reason for things that are happening. I like a nice old world fable, as I've said before. And so I come down on the side of this movie. I like the sequels, too.
You know, it's been a long time since I've seen the sequel, so I'll have to pile those on. Did you ever fuck with the remake?
The remake is one of those remakes. It's one of those where it's just real lukewarm and inessential. And it's just like, why did you even bother associating this with the... It loses a little bit of the charm of the original. I mean, updated effects are always nice, but I mean, it's real inessential.
Yeah, I started watching it and then I'm just like, this feels pointless. I've got other stuff to do. I used to be such a completist for this podcast, but my movie watching time is at a premium now.
Toby Hooper directed the fucking Mangler?
The first one, yeah.
Huh. All right. Sure, why not? It wasn't the worst, you know?
No, the sequel to the Mangler was the worst. That said, the Mangler was not good. My love to Toby Hooper, but sorry. That was not one of my favorites.
I mean, I do like it because it's one of those ones where, like, it's about a phenomenon so specific, you know?
Yeah.
But not quite specific enough to be, like, you know, like an evil bong type thing.
It's not Deathbed, the bed that eats, but it's close.
But a laundry press, like an evil laundry press. That clearly would not have been made if anybody was associated with it but Stephen King. So maybe that's actually the we've often tried to crack the formula for the Stephen King variability. It's that his cachet gets things pitched that should be cut off at the pass in the first place. Like a short story about an oppressive workplace where one of the machines occasionally gobbles up a worker is a good idea. A two-hour movie trying to replicate that atmosphere, you know, Graveyard Shift was very similar, although I'd say a little more successful because it's just so over the top with some of the performances in that and the ultimate creature reveal and the catacombs under the old mill and stuff. Make it a good monster movie, if not a good horror movie, you know?
Sure. I mean, while we're on that track, Matt, why don't we just keep going? Do you have any if-then recommendations for Poltergeist?
We have to put Poltergeist 2 and 3 on the list, right?
Of course, yeah. That those are gimmies.
I do want to particularly stick up for 3, which 3 is a really creepy movie.
It is. That's the one with Tom Skerritt in it, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was the one where they were having, you know, all the problems that we mentioned make it very disjointed. Like, it doesn't really proceed as a good linear sequel from the first one or the second one. And the idea is that, like, because of all the events of 1 and 2, Carol Ann is staying with, I believe...
It's her uncle, isn't it? Tom Skerritt's her uncle?
Tom Skerritt's character is Craig T. Nelson's character's brother, or his wife is Jo Beth Williams' character's sister. But yeah, she goes to stay with Tio and Tia, and has a different older sister figure. They live in a new high-rise he is the architect of. which is a very, you know, it's very reminiscent of the setup from One, because he's responsible for the engineering of this, you know, new high-tech building, and all the devices start to go wrong. But there's some very creepy imagery. Like, his wife is some sort of gallery curator, and like there's like some scenes where like some modern art moves when no one's looking and some stuff like that. Like, they're very surreal and disquieting, and they're sort of overlooked. It's one of those like kind of like Exorcist 3 is the one that like everybody's like, actually a really weird movie. Like, it doesn't particularly belong in the trilogy, but it's good on its own, you know?
So for my if then, I'm kind of jumping on the haunted house bandwagon and saying that depending on what end of the spectrum you're on, if you're into spooky, scary, and good effects, I'm going to recommend the original, I think, or not the original, the remake of House on Haunted Hill from, I believe it's 1998 or 99. I'm not going to look it up because that would just be, I would not be the stubborn man I am if I did. But that one is really fun. It's a redux of the William Castle schlocky, gimmicky House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price. And it's one of those things that I think it understands the assignment. The characters and the actors on screen are having just enough fun with it that it translates, and it is fun. Not as warm on the ending on that one, but it is a small thing to overlook for a very fun rest of the movie. The other end of the spectrum, I'm going to do Mike Flanagan. I know everybody's on Mike Flanagan's Fall of the House of Usher. I have not dug in yet, but I want to stump for the original Mike Flanagan Netflix series, which was The Haunting of Hill House, which I thought was a non-faithful but very well served for the medium adaptation of that work by Shirley Jackson.
Also, I'd like to take a moment to mention, if you watch The Haunting of Hill House, The Haunting of Hill House is very visually clever and visually packed with like some kind of almost magic eye moments and Where's Waldo moments. So do not do yourself a disservice and binge watch it while you wash the dishes or read a book or whatever. Like, it's one to sit and watch the stuff on the screen.
And I'm also going to throw out a little Zelda Rubinstein love, who played Tangina in this, also makes a wonderful cameo appearance in the oft overlooked, somewhat under discussed Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, which is kind of a both found footage movie and a meta slasher movie in the vein of Scream. And so that's a really fun one for this time of the year. And Zelda Rubinstein plays kind of a lore dumpy librarian in that, in a very meta moment. And it's a lot of fun seeing her in that movie, especially having grown up watching her. She's throughout the trilogy, is she not? Or is she just in 1 and 3?
She's pivotal in 2, and she makes it into 3 a little bit, I think.
I remember she's in the end of 3. Like, I remember that scene vividly.
Yeah, because the aunt goes through the mirror, you know, in a very pointed callback to Poltergeist 1.
Well, and me and my friend used to scream Carol Ann, outside in at each other on the playground incessantly.
But she's definitely in 2, because she lore dumps everything with the pilgrim, and she introduces the other kind of shaman character. Other than Carol Ann, she might be the most consistent anchor in it. I'm going to squeeze in a recommendation for One. It's not particularly tonally consistent with Poltergeist itself, but it is also directed by Tobe Hooper. And if you have seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and for some reason you let other people being Debbie Downers put you off ever watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, you're fucking up, bud.
13 years ago, audiences across America were horrified by the savagery of a faceless killer. In the wake of this bizarre rampage, he vanished. Now, after more than a decade of silence, he has come out of hiding. Chainsaw Massacre 2, The Buzz is back, directed by Tobe Hooper.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is to Texas Chainsaw Massacre what Evil Dead 2 is to Evil Dead. It's that level of turnaround, and it's that level of good.
Yeah, it's beyond goofy. It's a big, crazy movie where essentially the Sawyer family is revealed to almost be chuds. And It has Dennis Hopper, no relation to Toby Hooper, I believe, just similar names, as a Southern sheriff with chainsaw holsters.
Yep.
For his mini chainsaw sidearms. It's just a big, crazy, kind of more of almost a Hills Have Eyes level, this is lunacy kind of movie. And it seems to be like kind of the one people seem to kind of skip over two to three, which has, you know, new distinct kind of gross mutant Sawyers, but otherwise is kind of tepid. And then there's the, what is it? The New Beginning, the one with
Matthew McConaughey.
Because like the entire cast later became famous. It's like Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger and, you know,
very Austin, Texas. People.
Yeah, that's the one that, like, the Toby Hooper movie that I think is underlooked. And I'm just going to throw the Mangler on there because I had to watch it, so should you.
All right, Matt. Well, I think that's going to wrap things up for this edition of Monstoberfest on the Nighthawks podcast. Happy Halloween, everybody. Just happy Halloween for the season. And, yeah.
Monstoberfest.
Be sure to find us on Ko-fi. That link will be on our show notes. Also find us on the podcatcher of your choosing, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Audible, iHeartRadio, Deezer, wherever fine podcasts are found, we will be there. And be sure to leave a rate and review when you can.
Remember, we're like one of those things where like every dollar you spend buys a poor person a sandwich, except without the middleman, because we are poor and we need sandwiches.
Yes, you would be buying us the sandwich, and that would be a huge help to this production. I get hangry.
Any rumors you hear that every $10 in Ko-fi money buys another brick for the bizarre Nighthawks pyramid that we are erecting in Salt Lake City is a lie, because that pyramid's already there. There's a pyramid. There's a cult pyramid right in my neighborhood, Trevor.
But we're not a cult.
Less than a quarter mile from my house, there are multiple things built by cults, and not that cult. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about little cults.
Oh, you're not talking about the big one out there. You're talking about...
No, there's legitimately some kind of weird-ass mummify your cat Egyptology cult like a block from my house, just kicking it.
Well, as long as they're not committing suicide to meet Jesus behind the comet, are they hurting anybody?
They're actually not evangelical, and they're kind of hostile if journalists or somebody knock on their door and go, we couldn't help but notice you built a pyramid in a working-class neighborhood in the middle of Old Salt Lake. You want to comment on why pyramid? They just are like, no comment. There's just a mysterious cult pyramid in my neighborhood next to one of the world's largest haunted houses. And I just have to live with the fact that there is a cult pyramid that is secretive, literally in the shadows of a giant haunted attraction that is not secretive. And that's within walking distance of my house, as is a really good El Salvadorian restaurant. that's just my life. And that's why Utah needs to legalize it, recreationally speaking. To help me cope.
Was the pyramid built on an old cemetery, though?
I mean, probably a Ute one.
You know, it's worth mentioning before we close out officially that this really happened. It's happened a couple different times, but like relatively close to where we grew up.
You want to know a crazy one? There is a municipality that is part of the greater San Francisco metro area called Colma, California, that is essentially urban North America's most significant necropolis, because it's where they moved tons of like many, many cemeteries were aggregated there when they urbanized San Francisco. So there is an American necropolis. It is in San Francisco.
Well, and then Denver, Cheeseman Park, is one where the city was expanding. They needed to expand in this area where a cemetery was, and they contracted to have the cemetery moved. The contractor was not on the up and up. He did some shady shit up into and including like cutting bodies in half and counting them as two people and things like that. Or, you know, throwing two bodies in a casket and burying it in one grave. But mostly he moved headstones and not the bodies. And so here in this really ritzy area of old downtown Denver is an existing cemetery with no headstones. Every year they'll dig up in Cheeseman Park somewhere and kick up a body. And the same thing happened at the University of Wyoming, where when they were expanding the university, they ran into a cemetery. They moved the cemetery, but didn't do a very good job. And sure enough, every now and then they'll be doing work on the halls or the dorms, and they'll kick up a frontier grave with poker chips and cowboy hat intact.
It was pretty common in the American West to just have a little family plot or something, because like it's not like when you think back to like Civil War era Laramie, Wyoming, there wasn't much there, folks.
Oh yeah, they just kind of plant you where you landed.
Yeah, with most of Colma's land dedicated to cemeteries, the population of the dead is speculated to be around 1.5 million, outnumbering the ratio of the living residents by nearly 1,000 to 1. This has led to Colma being called the City of the Silent and gave rise to a humorous motto formerly featured on the town seal and website. It's great to be alive in Colma. Population as of the 2020 census was 1,507. So if you're looking for, you know, relatively cheap digs in the San Francisco area and you're not real scared of ghosts, I would say look for a nice attic apartment somewhere in Colma.
And I would say have yourself some coffee and pie, because it's almost morning. Aha, I took it away from you.
Stay classy, San Diego.
San Francisco. Colma.
The Summum Pyramid. Summum is a religion and philosophy that began in 1975 as a result of American citizen Claude Corky Nowell's claimed encounter with beings he described as Summa individuals. According to Nowell, these beings presented him with concepts regarding the nature of creation, concepts that have always existed and are continually reintroduced to humankind by advanced beings. He changed his name to Sumnum Bonum Amun Ra, but news stories indicate he still mostly goes by Corky Ra. Sumnum religious practices draw upon ancient Egyptian religion and the Hebrew prophet Moses. What the shit? Government authorities consider the nectars produced by Sumnum for their rituals to be wine and require Sumnum obtain a winery license, making them Utah's first federally bonded winery. They had a landmark free speech case when they demanded their 7 aphorisms be placed in public schools next to the 10 Commandments. February 25th, 2009, Supreme Court ruled unanimously against Sumnum in the Pleasant Grove case. Justice Samuel Alito asserted the municipality's acquisition of a privately funded monument in a public park while refusing to accept other privately funded memorials is a valid expression of governmental speech. Man, Samuel Alito's just a piece of shit.